Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who pushed Western civilization into the Age of Enlightenment? When Isaac Newton was coming of age in the 1660s, London and other great European cities were still tormented by pestilence, fire, and the fear that astronomical events were messages from an angry god. By the time he died in 1727, scholars had tools like telescopes, microscopes, and advanced mathematics at their disposal, and they widely accepted the idea that the Earth revolved around the Sun and the Moon around the Earth due to the forces of gravity. Author Edward Dalnick's new book takes us back to the dawn of contemporary science with stories of Newton and his remarkable, courageous, and highly competitive peers. It's called The Clockwork Universe: Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. Ed, welcome back to Think.
Thanks very much.
You do a wonderful job here setting the scene for us in the middle part of the 17th century, and frankly, it is a very depressing and scary one. Can you tell us what life was like in England in particular?
Well, life was pretty rotten, actually. We think of this, if we think of it at all, as a golden age. This is when the modern world was born. But the modern world was born out of chaos. This was the era of the Black Plague, when day after day, hundreds and then thousands of people drop dead. No one knows why. And when that goes away, the London catches on fire and the whole city burns. Prison bars in melt. It's out of this world of crisis and calamity is when this notion of perfect order and a scientific explanation comes. It's very strange that it should come at that time.
Yeah, and before people understood what caused any of these things, they really looked to the Bible and to religion to try and explain the scientific workings of the universe. I thought it was interesting. People were already worried about the arrival of the year 1666 because it contained those numbers that are signify the mark of the beast. But in fact, it was a year earlier that the plague took hold of London.
Just when everyone was scared of 1666 for just the reasons you say, because of 666, the plague hits, the great fire hits, and meanwhile, overhead, there are comets in the sky. And comets in this era were as terrifying a message as could be. Our word disaster, the dis part is from disgrace or disfavor, and the aster is from the Latin word for comet. So this is the scariest thing you could see. This is a message from God, mend your ways. And here, a comet appears in the sky and finally disappears, and then a second comet comes. So people were really cowering in 1666.
And the comets to them didn't look like icy snowballs, which we know them, or dirty snowballs, I should say, which we know them now to be. They looked like daggers.
Yeah, the comets were a kind of Rorschach test centuries before there was such a notion. You would look at this kind of blurry light in the sky, and if you were terrified of it, which everybody was, you saw it, just as you say, not as a blur or as a light, but as a sword or as a knife or as a dagger, something dangerous and violent and aimed at you.
So Isaac Newton actually left his studies at Cambridge in 1666 because of the spread of the plague. Talk a little bit about what his education was like.
Well, Newton was a very, very strange duck from the very beginning. He went to Cambridge as a young man at about the ordinary age. He's a college undergraduate. Nobody has heard of him. Nobody knows anything about him. He doesn't catch on that he's very special. And after a couple of years at college, the plague does hit England. Cambridge sends all its students home because the notion was that the disease spread wherever there was crowds. So he goes home by himself. He's a farm boy. His father was illiterate. His mother nearly so. She wanted him to take over the farm. He had no interest in doing that. All alone, he sits down and he thinks. And what he thought up with this unknown teenager is what people are still studying in science classes hundreds of years later.
And we should say it sort of makes sense that he would try to isolate himself even at home, because he was not a happy son. At one point, he threatened to burn up his mother and stepfather.
Newton, through his whole life, was he was bad-tempered, sullen, solitary character. It became clear at some point that he really was a brilliant man, and so people would give him a lot of leeway. But even so, he was a prickly, nasty character. This was the last person in the world you would have a drink with.
He was a deeply religious person, but he did not hold an orthodox sort of faith. Can you talk about how his beliefs differed from the Church of England?
Newton was deeply religious. That's one of the most important things to know about him. Everything that happened happened for a purpose, and the purpose was that God had willed it so. But Newton secretly held to a quite strict interpretation of the Bible, which was at odds with Church of England doctrine. Newton thought that the Church of England had gone too soft. They were indulgent in a kind of glamorous, pageant-heavy kind of ritual that he didn't believe in, although he was afraid to say so publicly for fear that he would be punished for his heresy.
What got him and his contemporaries thinking that God, in fact, wished for man to understand his will through through science and mathematics?
The notion that Newton and his peers believed was that the world was a kind of puzzle set by God. God had arranged things like the world's hardest crossword puzzle, or maybe scavenger hunt, and if we were clever enough, we would figure it out. And the reason they thought that God had done things that way was that God had endowed us with intellect. That was the gift that made humankind special, and the way we could best honor God was to use that gift to its fullest extent to solve the riddle that he had written for us.
And so scientists at the time, we'll talk about the Royal Society in a minute, but they still, at this era, were spending as much time on things like alchemy as they were on trying to understand new kinds of math.
Everything new and old was all mixed together. Astrology and astronomy were still the same thing. Medicine had all kinds of quack remedies. One of the greatest scientists of the day believed that death sweat, he called it, which was a remedy for all kinds of illnesses. And what death sweat was that if you took a man who had been hanged and you cut off his hands and you rubbed those hands, there was some magical essence in it that would cure you. This was what the greatest scientific thinkers of the age believed.
Yeah, it took a long time for medicine to catch up to what was going on in mathematics.
Medicine always lingered behind, but on the other hand, people cared about it like mad because they were dropping dead mysteriously at any time.
So we know that Newton did have a pretty friendly relationship, if you can call it that, with Edmund Halley, who's best known for the comet that was named in his honor. Can you talk about the influence they had on one another?
Halley was much younger, and Halley was a remarkable man. He was not only brilliant, but almost unique in this set. He was a friendly, sociable fellow. He was one of those people, if you couldn't get along with Halley, you couldn't get along with anybody. And at some point, it became clear that Newton had done something brilliant, but he wouldn't tell anyone about it. Hmm. And it fell to Halley to coax Newton to publish his great masterpiece, which turned out to be this theory of how gravity works. Only Halley could persuade Newton that it was really worth telling the world. And so Halley has this unenviable task of trying to explain to Newton that really the world would be better off if only you would share this secret knowledge of yours.
What made Newton want to keep it a secret?
Well, Newton was always a strange man. He couldn't bear criticism. He could bear adulation. So if you were going to say, "Oh my God, I can't believe how brilliant this was," that was fine. And he had a few hangers-on who would say that. But he always feared that if he were to publish any theory, there would be somebody who said, "It's not so good," or "I thought of it myself," or "I don't see what the point is." And he couldn't abide being treated in that way.
How much truth is there, Ed, to the apple story?
Well, this is a curious story. The one thing that everybody knows about Isaac Newton is that an apple fell and he saw it. A lot of people think that the apple actually conked him on the head. It's one of the few myths in science that is possible it is true. Newton himself told it. He told it in old age. So on the one hand, it comes straight from the source. On the other hand, he liked to tell stories about what a remarkable fellow he was. So no one is quite sure.
So, you know, obviously people had known since the dawn of time that if an apple came loose from a tree, it would fall. How did he make the connection between that apple falling to the earth and the fact that the moon did not fall to the earth?
Well, that's a terrific question, and you're absolutely right. Everybody did know that apples fall. Every baby knows that if he drops his rattle, you look to the ground. Everyone knows that. What Newton figured out was, first of all, that it was worth noticing, that there was something there. Why does it fall? How does it fall? And then to look at out at the night sky and to see the planets and to see the moon and to make this abstract leap that the moon is just like a rock. The moon is falling. It doesn't seem to be falling. It seems to be just sitting there. So Newton explained, first of all, in what sense the moon is falling, and then he showed that a law governs how the moon falls and a law governs how a baby's rattle falls or an apple falls, and it's exactly the same law. That's what he showed, and the world was bowled over by that.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the reaction. When Principia Mathematica was published, was it an overnight sensation?
Well, it was an overnight sensation in a very, very small set. It was a terribly hard book.
Yeah.
It dense with mathematics. There's no explanation of where he's headed or why he's making these arguments. At the end, he says in what amounts to a fanfare of trumpets, ta-da, here's my theory. The very few people who could understand it knew at once that this was a big deal. And then there's a time lag while they set out to translate it into more ordinary language. There's a lag while you wait for the equivalent of Carl Sagan to come along and say, pay attention to this.
Or Edward Dolnick. And the book was written originally in Latin.
Yeah, it was, which only added to the difficulty. Although in those days, scholarly books were typically written in Latin. So that in itself didn't set it apart from other things. What made it so hard was that there are no concessions to the reader. It's like the world's hardest geometry book.
So Newton had this work 10 years ahead of anybody else, but in fact, someone else laboring, in solitude, was also coming to the same conclusions, Gottfried Leibniz.
Yeah, what Newton needed, what made the world work, was some way to talk about things that are moving, a cannonball shooting through the air or an arrow. Nobody before the 1600s knew how to talk about that. The Greeks knew how to talk about a circle or a sphere, as long as it was just sitting there. You needed to invent a new kind of math, which is called calculus, to talk about things that are moving. Newton figured it out during those plague years as a teenager when he was sitting at home. Unbeknownst to him, this brilliant German named Leibniz figured out the same thing. Neither of them told the other. Each one took for granted that he was so uniquely capable in all the world that nobody else could possibly figure out what he had done. Eventually, they both said, here's this great invention. It's called calculus. It will revolutionize the world. Each decided that the other must have stolen it from him. And for the rest of their long lives, Newton and Leibniz and followers on both sides fought about whose idea this had really been.
Did they ever actually meet in the same room?
No, they never did. Leibniz was an outgoing, friendlier, bustling character, kind of the smartest boy in fifth grade grown up. He would have liked to meet. Newton would have resisted it. If you were to meet him, your job was to pay homage, not to say, you know, I'm just as capable as you are.
Edward Dolnick is my guest. He's an author and former chief science writer for the Boston Globe. His new book is called The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or drop us an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Edward Dolnick. He's former chief science writer for the Boston Globe and author of the new book, The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Matthew, who writes, I hope you talk about the Royal Society member Robert Hooke, who was just as brilliant as Newton and delved into a greater variety of subjects. He merits his own chapter in the book.
Well, Robert Hooke was a very impressive fellow. He was yet another of those that Newton feuded with. Neither could bear the other. Newton would stalk out of the room if Hooke happened to appear. Hooke was a tiny, misshapen, bad-tempered, brilliant fellow in his own right. One book about him is called London's Leonardo, Leonardo da Vinci. Hooke had magic in his hands. He could build anything. And in the Royal Society's early meetings, Hooke was the star. He would show his latest gizmos, and people would marvel. His favorite was a bell jar. He figured out a way you could pump the air out of a jar, and he would put inside it snakes or chickens or mice, and the Royal Society members would gather around and pump out the air and watch to see if the critter would keel over and how long it would take. And they had no idea what was the mysterious substance in air that some animals needed and other animals didn't seem to need so much of. And at one point, Hooke managed to make a giant version of this bell jar, so big that he could climb it himself, and he gave the signal to pump out the air. But before he could manage to kill himself, the machine malfunctioned, and he staggered out dizzy and half deaf. So he didn't quite kill himself, but this was a pretty good show anyway, and people were quite impressed.
I guess the world was better off given that malfunction.
It was good to have him around, but he was a showman.
Of course, this was also a time when people were just discovering what the world looked like on a micro scale. Talk about Antony Leeuwenhoek and what changed when we started to understand that there were things the human eye could not perceive.
Leeuwenhoek was a Dutch cloth merchant. Originally started using lenses to check out the quality of cloth samples. Got more and more interested. Made what were essentially the first microscopes, and more important is the first to look through them. Now everybody knows if you look through a microscope, like at a drop of pond water, you'll see little critters swimming around. But he was the first to see it, and he was astonished at it. And people crowded around to have a peek themselves, and no one could believe what went on. And one of the conclusions they drew was that here, on a microscopic level, things too small to see were still to be discovered and were perfect. God had fashioned them too, even though we wouldn't be able to see them until we had developed this microscope. This showed what a meticulous and brilliant craftsman God was, that he worked on a level even more than we could detect with the naked eye.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Brian in Fort Worth. Hi, Brian.
Yes, I was wondering if Newton ever feared or underwent kind of religious persecution from any sect or anything, like Galileo, because I would guess prior to Newton, if an apple fell from a tree, the common person or scientist or alchemist would look at it and think, well, that's the direct hand of God. And after Newton came along, Newton showed that it can happen due to a natural law and God's direct hand. So it kind of pushes God back a little bit. Was there any fear, or did he undergo any kind of religious persecution? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, it's a terrific and important question. The short answer is that Newton did not undergo religious persecution. But it's a giant story. Why the scientific vanguard, why the most advanced scientific thinking changed from Italian scientists to English scientists. And a big part of the reason is that in Italy, science was persecuted. Everyone knows Galileo's story. And in England, science was honored. What happened was that Galileo was persecuted because his scientific teachings, the church said, were an affront to God. They violated biblical teachings. And in England, the scientists were just as devout as Galileo had been, but the way they saw things was that scientific discoveries were homages to God. They showed what masterpieces God had created, and to do science was to honor and to pay respect to the variety of God's creation.
And throughout all this time, Newton was continually sort of trawling through the Bible, looking to see if there were secret codes hidden in there. If the world could discover things with scientific observation, maybe looking more closely at this sacred text would teach us something.
That's exactly right. In Newton's day, not just Newton, but all the eminent scientists took for granted that you could learn about the world by looking at the Bible just as well as by looking at the natural world. The natural world was God's creation, and the Bible was God's book. He had made both, and so both contained these hidden coded messages of what he had intended. The point of science was to try to read God's mind. You could read it in the Bible. You could read it in the natural world. These scientists would have loved Da Vinci Code.
Ed, talk a little bit about the Royal Society and how it was set up and who could join. And, of course, we didn't have Newton becoming president until 1703 or 4, I guess, but it had existed since the 1660s.
The Royal Society took shape as this kind of informal collection of terribly smart men, all men in those days, but also nearly anyone who was interested in what was doing. It was a see and be seen kind of place. So at the same meeting, you would have people like Robert Hooke, this brilliant, bad-tempered scientist, or Christopher Wren, the man who built St. Paul's Cathedral and was also an eminent astronomer, all kinds of people like this, and whoever was the man of the hour, the equivalent of Donald Trump, these people with no scientific credentials but big bankrolls or fancy reputations who wanted to know the latest. And they would all gather around and watch these things like the bell jar or the Royal Society members were constantly making mixtures of one thing or another and throwing them in the fire in the hope that it would explode. This was more like a meeting of the world's smartest, rowdiest Cub Scouts than a formal, austere scientific meeting.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Wichita Falls, and we have Gabriel on the line. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi, yeah. I was wondering if you're worried about, a return to a new Dark Ages. There seems to be such a strong anti-intellectual, anti-scientific movement abroad. I mean, we have Texas wanting to rewrite science standards to allow for supernatural explanations, that type of thing.
Do you think that's a danger, Ed?
Well, there is a strong anti-intellectual bias in the world now, which is not a welcome thing. Part of what made Newton and his peers so important and so influential was that they showed that the human mind was capable of grasping the world. We were capable of figuring out a tremendous variety of things, and that knowledge was important and made the world a vastly better place than it had been. You had talked about medicine as only one example, but technology depended on science. Science for its own sake, making sense of the what could seem chaotic out there if you weren't aware of it. This whole creation of meaning where there had been only disorder was a product of the scientific world, and it's one of the most valuable products.
We have an email here from Hamid in Dallas, who writes, I heard that Newton refused the Trinity as the central pillar of Christianity to the point that he almost gave up his chair position at Cambridge. Can you comment on that? He was an anti-Trinitarian. Is that the term?
Yes. Newton's religious views were a matter of tremendous importance to him, and they would have been a source of great dispute at the time. The particular question had to do with whether Jesus was a prophet, a human being to be especially admired, but in fact human, or whether he was godlike. Newton's secret position, which would have got him in trouble, was that Jesus was a especially eminent human being, but a human being.
Let me ask you this. In the modern world, it is rare, if not impossible, to find someone who is considered an expert in a variety of disciplines, many branches of science and mathematics and theology and music and art and literature. Do you think humankind and the human potential has lost something in exchange for something else in this age of specialization of expertise?
Well, it was a remarkable feature of life early on that one person, one brilliant person, could aspire to know what seemed like everything.
Mm-hmm.
And these men of the Royal Society were astonishing characters. Leibniz, the fellow who was Newton's rival for inventing calculus, was a philosopher and a mathematician and nearly everything else. One of his contemporaries said that when you encountered Leibniz, it made you just want to crawl away into some dark corner of the room and curl up and die. You felt so outshadowed by him. For me, I have a kind of romantic notion about these great geniuses, and I like the idea that there were people of that titanic caliber.
Yeah.
The usual notion is that around 1900 or so, the world got so complicated that there was nobody who could keep it all in his mind.
What does it take for you to explain things to those of us who don't have a background in science? Because I don't especially, but I was able to understand the things that you were writing about.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. That's really one of the main things I'm after. There's a kind of book that where the point seems to be to convince you that the author is a terribly bright fellow. I don't like that kind of book. I wanted the reader to feel at the end of the book, you know, I'm kind of a bright person. That was my hope, that these ideas that a lot of people put their fingers in their ears and go, ooh, are actually pretty great ideas. And if you have a minute's time to read some explanation, you can catch on to things that you might never have bothered to think about. And some of those ideas are really exciting ideas.
By the way, I have to tell you, my favorite gee whiz fact of the entire book has nothing to do with science or mathematics. Maybe that will disappoint you. But this word that I, for my entire life, have been pronouncing ye, as in ye old tavern or ye old counting house, in fact, in London in the 17th century, would have been pronounced the.
Well, that is quite neat. And I hadn't known it myself. And I always liked these ye olde taverns.
You know, always with the E on the end of everything.
Right, right. And so that was, I hadn't known that. Through the book, there are little, I hope, fun discoveries like that of things that I hadn't known. I'm surprised that I had never run into it, but I didn't know.
Mike wants to know via email regarding the assumed centrality of God in the scientific community in Newton's day. Were there no agnostics or atheists of note?
No, there weren't. The notion of an atheist, people used the word atheist, but it was an all-purpose slur the way in the 50s people used the word pinko. It didn't mean specifically to deny God. It just meant that you were a person not to be trusted. No, even the most radical thinker couldn't entertain the notion that there wasn't a God. The radicals might say that God had it in for us for some mysterious reason or something like that, but they thought that to say there was no God simply didn't make sense. It would be like saying, could it be that that time runs backward? It was a question that they couldn't turn into a meaningful question.
Did the Royal Society serve any sort of peer review function for its members?
No. The notion of how you get an idea accepted and what it means for a new idea to be legitimate, that took a long time to sort out. In the early days, the scientists, by happenstance, were mostly cantankerous, competitive people. There was no formal system for who got credit for a discovery. And so they all, there was all kinds of infighting and bickering and name-calling, really, really quite vicious. And the fights went on for years. People wouldn't speak to one another. They would enlist their backers to write anonymous attacks on the other guy. It was really a nasty business.
So how and why did the Royal Society of London gain sort of prestige under Newton's direction?
Well, what happened is that it was a mix of brilliant ideas and crazy stuff. So in the same meeting, Hooke is doing something with putting a candle or a mouse under a bell jar, say, and that's genuinely significant. And then the next person would come up and give a speech about magical properties of unicorn horns, and that wasn't so significant. And then Christopher Wren would give a talk about the planet Saturn, and that genuinely was important. And eventually, there were enough of these genuinely important things that people caught on. You know, this is something worth paying attention to. But it took a long time, partly because the science was so new that it was easy to make fun of. A lot of it sounded silly. And partly because there was a lot of nuttiness mixed in with the good ideas.
Was there any profit to be made from achievement in science and mathematics back then?
No, hardly any. There were, if you made instruments, if you made a telescope or you made a microscope, that might be a good thing. You could get a job as a university professor, and so there was money to be made in that sense. But no, it was like being a poet today, say.
We have an email here from Brian in Wiley. By the way, our email address is think@kera.org. Brian wants to know, was the age of the Earth a question that Newton considered?
No. No, he took for granted, and everybody took for granted, that the universe, that the Earth was brand new. It was thousands of years old. All the progress that these people are making, virtually all, is in physics. The notion of evolution, of biology, takes another couple of centuries to come along. And why that is an important question. But Newton is in the middle of the 1600s. Darwin is in the middle of the 1800s. You might think that Darwin would come first, because Darwin's theory was about everyday things. It was about barnacles and fossils. Newton's theory was terribly hard. It had to do with math and the planets and things that are much more abstract. How come the hard theory came first, and first by two centuries?
Edward Dalnick is my guest. He is former chief science writer for the Boston Globe and author of the new book, The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. You can be part of this conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Edward Dalnick. He's an author and former chief science writer for the Boston Globe. His new book is called The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. Join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Ed, one really striking thing reading through this book, and all of these different scientists are listed, It seems as if a lot of them were sort of washed up or at least finished with their most important discoveries by the time they got to 35 or 40. Now, I know people didn't live that long, but Newton himself lived to be 84.
Yeah, it's a dismaying feature of the world that in science, especially in the most abstract fields like math and physics and even chess, people burn out like athletes. You do your great work at 20, in your 20s, by 30, you're an old timer. In lots of fields, that's not so. In art and literature, you tend to be able to hang on much, much longer. But physicists nearly always burn out awfully quickly. They talk about that. They have a kind of fatalism about you'd better do it quick because time's going.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have a question here from Mohammed who wants to know if Newton learned or borrowed anything from Muslim scientists.
No, he didn't. It was later learned, tremendous science going on in the non-European world, but Newton didn't know about it.
We have an email here also from F, who asks, we hear a great deal about Leibniz and Newton in terms of development of calculus, but we never hear much about John Wallace and his contribution.
Well, there's a question with the kind of encouraging presumption. We hear a lot about Newton and Leibniz. Newton and Leibniz are the fellows who are given credit for inventing calculus, and they did do that. They didn't do it out of the blue. They had brilliant predecessors. One of them was this fellow Wallace, and in fact, Wallace was one of the few mathematicians, contrary to what I was saying a few minutes ago, who he didn't burn out. He was still doing math as an old man, which almost nobody did. Newton and Leibniz did build on the work of people like Wallace. But it is also clear that Newton and Leibniz, were far greater figures.
Were the conclusion of Leibniz and Newton measurably different in any particular areas of calculus?
No, they did the same thing, although Leibniz did it in a way, he wrote it down in a way that's easier to understand, was much easier for other people to follow. And so the consequence was that science and math in Europe, where Leibniz was, got a big head start on science in England, where Newton was, because nobody quite was able to follow what it was that Newton was up to. They weren't able to understand his language. And so although the idea was the same, Leibniz put it in a much more approachable way and therefore had many more followers, and that made for a big advance in Europe.
How did the world's understanding of gravity sort of push forward the study of the cosmos?
Well, the great thing was that two fields that had seemed utterly separate, mm-hmm. what goes on here on Earth when you drop rocks or when apples fall, and what goes on in the heaven, how the planets go around, that kind of thing, turned out to be the same thing. That was the great thing that Newton showed. There had been scientists interested in the skies and scientists interested in the Earth, and now Newton showed that one theory would account for them all. And so that made for a huge increase in people working on both. And a lot of the drama went to the astronomers, that they were making new discoveries like mad, encouraged by this demonstration by Newton that the heavens, that science extended to the heavens as well as to Earth.
How long did it take to really demystify what was going on in space, to the extent that most people no longer feared the appearance of a comet or the event of an eclipse?
It took longer than you would think. But what happens? So Newton is alive in the 1600s. Around 1700 is when people have heard of his things. And during the course of the 1700s, the word spreads that no, you don't have angels pushing the planets around, and eclipses don't show that God is displeased with us. People didn't quite know what the real theory was, because it's hard going, but they did catch on to the big picture that this was the domain of science and not the domain of theology.
Since you bring this up in the book, I'll ask the question. We know that Newton never married. How do you know that he died a virgin?
Well, this is, we take Newton's word for it. He was quite proud of himself. When he was an old man, he bragged to a couple of people, one of them his doctor, that he had remained a virgin his whole life. Considering what an unpleasant fellow he was, it's not a giant surprise. But the reason he bragged about it wasn't to show that he was surlier than anyone else. It was to show that he was above worldly concerns and a deep and abstract and solemn person.
Talk about some of the other ways that he was just a strange character. We know he wasn't much fun to be around. There are some people who believe he might have suffered from mercury poisoning. Is that right?
That's a theory, yes. He did all kinds of alchemy experiments, trying to convert one element into another, that sort of thing. And so it's possible, I don't think the evidence is very good, but it could be that he had poisoned himself. But the strangest feature of his character was this brilliance, first of all. There was essentially nobody who was able to keep up with him, except possibly Leibniz, as I say. But so he has a kind of Einstein-like brilliance from the start. But in addition to that, he had this notion that he was set apart from other people. He was special. It so happened that he was born on Christmas Day. It happened that his father had died a few months before Newton was born. And so he's this fatherless creature who comes into the world and then finds quickly that he has special powers. And he believed through his whole life that he had been set apart by God to understand God's cosmic code. And he did so many remarkable things that it might almost seem true.
Did he have a lot of direct contact with Buckingham Palace?
Toward the end of his life, when he was quite an esteemed and remarkable fellow, he was became kind of an ornament of London life, and he became friendly to the extent that he became friendly with anyone with the then Princess of Wales.
And he actually was given what amounted to a royal burial. Is that right?
Yeah, Newton, by the end of the day, he was the first scientific celebrity. He was, as I say, the Einstein of his day. People didn't know quite what it was that he had done in the same way as Einstein. But they knew he had done something great. They knew he was English, and in England that was a giant point in his favor. And so this farm boy born to illiterate parents, by the time he dies, is one of the most eminent men, almost literally worshipped in England, and buried with dukes and earls carrying his caskets, given what amounts to a royal funeral, all because his science was so great. So something that would have had him burned at the stake, as one of the callers said, if he'd lived in Italy in 1600, by the time he died in the 1720s, had him revered almost as a god.
You know, it's really interesting the competition that existed among different scientists, because they would sort of hold things very close to the vest and then they wanted all the credit for it. Was that competition, was it mostly personal or was it nationalistic in origin?
It started personally, and then the national pride built into it. All the English scientists had this notion that they had some kind of English commonsensical virtues, and the French were fops and effete, that kind of thing. And the French thought the English were brutes. But it was also just this personal pride. The notion had always been that if you had a terrific idea, you kept it to yourself, the way that if you knew where treasure was, you would keep the map to yourself. And so when the fashion changed, and when word came that if you have an important idea, you should publish it, you should tell everyone, this was terribly hard for scientists to live with at the beginning, because they thought it was like giving away their treasure.
Do you think it's possible there were discoveries made that we didn't realize existed until decades or centuries after they came to light?
It's certainly true that people who did brilliant things might not have got the credit for it. And we're only discovering occasionally that somebody or other who we thought was first to something was merely first to publish it, and that some other person who couldn't get much notice or for his own reasons thought he should keep it to himself was actually first there.
Talk about some of the things that the world can do today because we have infinitesimal calculus that wouldn't be possible without it.
Well, you can send a man to the moon. Nearly anything to do with modern engineering and technology, building bridges, sending railroads, knowing how to engineer a highway, knowing how to build an anti-braking system, anything that has to do with one thing moving along has to do with calculus. It was calculus that set the modern world in motion. It kind of pressed the button, the go button.
It would be really interesting to sit in on a meeting of the Royal Society and sort of listen to the kinds of things they were talking about and the sequence in which they discussed them. Was there an agenda? Were they formalized meetings?
No. It took a long time for it to become formal. It was it was catch as catch can, mostly run in the early days, as I say, by Hooke, this brilliant cantankerous fellow. And so it was a matter of who was the sharpest elbowed, who would get to present his ideas, who could push Hooke aside, or who could persuade Hooke to make a gadget to show whatever his new theory was. It was an informal system.
And Hooke was actually a little bit older than Newton, is that right?
Yeah, they were close in age, which made for part of the rivalry. Hooke had been hugely respected, and then Newton came along, and Newton was the new shining light. And Hooke wasn't pleased with that.
Was England the center of scientific discovery throughout the remainder of the 18th century?
Yes. When Newton comes along, this is a giant advantage. There is this problem, as I say, that Newton expressed himself in such a hard-to-understand way and was so prickly that he pushed other people away, that Europe advanced on its own. But England England was the home for a great number of advances.
How long did it take, Ed, for these discoveries to be added to the canon of things that students would have examined at a university level or even before then?
Well, that comes pretty quickly. It was realized by scientists and by the scientifically minded that this was a big deal. Newton was really on to something. And so you would study it quite quickly because it worked. You could actually do stuff. You could point your telescope at a particular place that no one had ever thought was worth looking at, and you would see something that was there. And the reason you knew it was there is that Newton's equations told you to look there, and you would find something.
Are there translations available today of the of Newton's famous book, The Principia Mathematica?
Yeah, there are all sorts of different ones. There are some that just literally translate it, and there are ones that comment on it and kind of explain your way through.
Now, for you, is this an easy read?
No, but not merely for me, but for people vastly more brilliant, it's not easy. Newton was one of those thinkers who did something great. He rose to great heights, and then he pulled the ladder up after him, so that it would be terribly hard for anybody else to follow him. Part of that was out of austerity. He didn't want to muck up his presentation with explanation for the ordinary reader. In part was to demonstrate just how powerful an intellect he had.
Did things change a lot in the Royal Society after Newton's death? Immediately
well,
after?
It became a... It was still terribly important. It exists to this day and is still quite important. But it became a much more formal, more orderly, more tidy place as time went along.
The last thing I want to ask you is whether you had a favorite gee whiz fact in doing all this research, something you had not heard before.
Well, one of the things I liked best was these notions of the Royal Society in its early meetings that things were so strange. There was one where there was an age-old belief that if you sprinkled powdered unicorn horn in a circle, put a spider inside it in the middle, the spider wouldn't be able to crawl out. And so they got something that they thought was unicorn, and they did this. And I love the picture of these brilliant men all crowded around the table looking at this stuff and watching the spider, who happily ran away time after time. You picture the men on their hands and knees in the corner trying to grab the spider and put him back in the circle and watch again. That's my favorite.
The new book by Edward Dalnick is The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. Ed, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.